go.
Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon. Let the record show that it is shortly after 1 p.m. on May 28th, 2014. We are present at the PSC hearing room in Bismarck, North Dakota for the public hearing in the matter of Montana Dakota Utilities Company's generation resource cost recovery rider and proposed initial rate increases. These are case numbers PU-14-108 and 109. My name is Wade Mann, and I am the procedural administrative law judge designated to preside over these matters. At this time, I will have each of the parties note their appearance for the record, beginning with MDU.
Daniel Kuntz, appearing for Montana Dakota Utilities Co.
And Mr. Kuntz, who do you have with you?
I have with me, seated at the table, Mr. Garrett Singer, who is the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs and Chief Accounting Officer for Montana Dakota.
Okay. And Commission Advocacy Staff?
Thank you, Your Honor. Ryan Norrell on behalf of Advocacy Staff, and with me is Mr. Mike Diller on behalf of Advocacy Staff as well.
And Commission Advisory Staff?
Ilana Jeffcoat-Sacco, and with me is, only he's not in the room at the moment, Jerry Lean, who's also Commission Advisor.
Okay. And also present today are the members of the Public Service Commission, Chairman Brian Kalk, Commissioner Randy Christman, and Commissioner Julie Fedorchek. I will call on the commissioners shortly for opening remarks after providing a brief summary of the matter before the commission today and addressing procedural issues for the hearing. MDU proposes to recover costs associated with its new 88-megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine generator, known as Heskett 3, located in Mandan, North Dakota. MDU sought approval of a generation resource cost recovery rider and proposed initial rate increases. The issue, as noticed for the public hearing, is whether the proposed generation resource cost recovery rider and proposed initial rate increase should be approved. Subsequent to the notice of hearing being issued, MDU and advocacy staff entered into a settlement agreement with respect to the rider and the rate increases, and that will be discussed today. Now, before we get started with the evidentiary portion of the hearing, I'll briefly address some procedural issues that will be followed in the matter today. MDU will make its presentation of the case first, calling its witnesses and offering any documentary evidence it wishes to rely upon into the record. And it is my understanding that MDU will intend to, with its first witness, address and call in the settlement agreement. Is that correct, Mr. Kuntz?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then follow that up with its other two witnesses to address the application.
That's correct.
And do the commissioners have any issue with that manner of presentation?
Not for me.
Okay. Any comment from advocacy staff with respect to proceeding in that matter?
No, Your Honor.
Advisory staff?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay, once counsel for MDU has finished questioning each of its witnesses, then advocacy staff will have the opportunity to question the witnesses, followed by advisory staff and the commissioners themselves. And once the commissioners have completed their questioning, then I will allow follow-up questions from MDU counsel, advocacy staff, advisory staff, and the commissioners again as needed. Upon completion of MDU's presentation of its case, advocacy staff will present its case in the same fashion. Counsel for MDU will have the opportunity to question advocacy staff witnesses, followed by advisory staff and the commissioners. I serve strictly as procedural ALJ in this matter. The commissioners will make the final determination as to the rider and the rates and whether or not to approve the proposed settlement agreement. No decision will be reached on the matter today. The proceedings are being recorded and will be available for review. And before we get started, are there any questions regarding the procedures to be followed today? Seeing none, we may proceed. At this time, I will take opening remarks from the commissioners. Whose portfolio is this? Ms. Fedorchek? Okay, Commissioner Fedorchek, go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. Well, this settlement was a little bit of a curveball for me. I was not expecting that when I looked at these materials over the weekend. And so looking forward to today's discussion on the settlement. I think it answers some of the questions that I had coming into this hearing. in terms of the revenues and how much the company needs. So I think that's one piece that I was pleased to see. I'm not sure procedurally, and I'm going to count on our attorneys to advise. We sent a notice for a hearing on the rider, and so this is a settlement. Is it the same? Is that, I mean, is this just what we do? You could always move it into a settlement and change the hearing into that. I guess I'm a little confused by just that procedural matter, but I'm trusting you all who've been doing this for years have already taken care of that. So this is an important project. We all know we need more generation resources in North Dakota, and this is a good one, and it seems to be efficiently handled and coming in lower than expected in terms of cost. So there's some real favorable items. Just excited to hear more about the terms of the settlement and how it came about and any other issues that we need to discuss today. Thank you.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have any comments. Get ready to get to it.
Commissioner Christman?
Your Honor, just ready to get started. I will just say, depending on this, how we're progressing with the hearing, if it seems like most of the information is already out there and that I would be able to capture everything from just reviewing the record, about a quarter after two or so, I may step out and go attend my aunt's burial over at the Veterans Cemetery, a great lady, great North Dakotan, great American, and so we'll see how things are progressing, so I may just step out.
Certainly. Thank you, Commissioner. And at this time, do any of the parties wish to make a brief opening statement?
Very briefly, Your Honor. Just kind of refresh the commission's recollection. There were three kind of what I would call key pieces to what the company had filed for. The first was just an implementation of a generation rider itself, which would basically put it in its tariffs, allow the company to have a generation rider that would allow for rate adjustments to recover the cost of new generation resources as they're added, rather than going through a general rate case each time these generations resources were added. So that's the first piece. The tariff, to establish the tariff that would go on as part of the company's rate sheets that's available there to be used under the right circumstances. The second piece of the commission's company's filing was in a rate adjustment under that tariff to recover the cost of Heskett 3, which is scheduled to go commissioned about July 1 or sometime in July. So the idea was that we would have an adjustment under that generation rider that would go into effect sometime in July to start recovering the cost of the investment associated with the Heskett 3 plant. And then the third piece of it was actually, as part of a supplemental filing, the company proposed to remove the cost of the gas pipeline from the recovery under the rider. Because of some opportunities to for additional sales off of that pipeline, rather than solely dedicated it to the electric side, so the electric side wouldn't be able to make sales off the pipeline, the company proposed that it would move the pipeline under the gas side of the business, then sell service to the electric side with the opportunities for credits for any third-party sales or other use of the pipeline as they occur. So at the end of the day, the recovery for the pipeline is still there through the electric customers, but with the opportunity for credits to those electric customers to the extent that we're able to utilize that pipeline to serve other customers without jeopardizing the dedication or the needs or the demands of the pipeline to serve the electric plant. So that looks like an opportunity for a win-win for both sides, the ability to utilize that pipeline for other uses but still have it available to meet the electric side. What you was referenced just recently, the advocacy staff and the company reached a settlement on these issues, plus a couple of other things that were added as part of that settlement, and resolves the issues that were laid out or the way the company and the advocacy staff is proposing to resolve them. As was indicated by the administrative law judge, we would propose to call Mr. Singer first to pre-file testimony in the settlement to explain how the company and the advocacy staff settlement would resolve the issues, and then we would then call Mr. Welty and Ms. Aberly to the stand who filed pre-file testimony under the original application. We don't intend to go into their pre-file testimony in any degree, but they would be available to establish the foundation for their pre-file testimony and then answer any questions the commission might have on that pre-file testimony. So that's the procedure that we would propose to use.
Okay. Mr. Norell, any opening statement?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any comments?
Nothing. Thank you.
Okay.
We would call Garrett Singer.
Okay. Mr. Singer, I'm required to advise you that perjury is a Class C felony in North Dakota, punishable by a maximum fine of $5,000, a maximum of 5 years imprisonment, or both. Being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay.
Would you please state your name and your business address, Mr. Singer?
My name is Garrett Singer, and my business address is 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck, North Dakota.
And you're employed by Montana Dakota?
That's correct.
And what's your position with Montana Dakota?
Vice President of Regulatory Affairs and the Chief Accounting Officer for Montana Dakota.
And have you pre-filed direct testimony in this proceeding, Mr. Singer?
I did.
I want to show you what's been marked as MDU Exhibit Number 6. Should be a copy in front of you in the notebook. You recognize that exhibit?
I do.
And is that a copy of the pre-file testimony that was filed in this proceeding?
It's my testimony.
And that testimony was prepared by you or under your direction?
It was.
Would you, we would offer Exhibit MDU 6.
Any objection, Mr. Norell?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. MDU Exhibit 6 is admitted.
I also, in front of you, Mr. Singer, is what's been marked MDU Exhibit Number 5. Do you recognize that document?
I do.
Can you tell us what that document is?
That is a settlement agreement with the advocacy staff.
And that settlement agreement was something that you were involved in negotiation with?
Correct.
And your signature appears on page 8 of that document?
It does.
And is that settlement agreement the subject of your testimony that was pre-filed in this proceeding?
That is correct.
We would offer MDU Exhibit Number 5.
Any objection?
No, Your Honor.
No, thank you.
Okay. MDU Exhibit Number 5 is admitted.
Mr. Singer, skipping over the preliminary piece of your pre-filed testimony, can you describe what the purpose of your testimony is in this proceeding?
The purpose of my testimony in this proceeding is to support the settlement agreement and lay out the basic foundation of that settlement agreement.
Would you explain the elements of the settlement agreement, please, for the commission?
Certainly. The key parts of the settlement with the advocacy staff include establishing a generation resource recovery rider for the recovery of large generation projects outside a general rate case. As part of the settlement, MDU withdraws its request to implement a rate adjustment under this rider at this time. The company may refile for a rate adjustment after August 1st should there be a need. For example, if we experience a cool summer or incurred unexpected costs, which could swiftly drive down our return. And the reason we're withdrawing then the rate under this settlement is that based on 4 months of actual results and 8 months of projections, the company anticipates to be in the range of its approved return. Okay. The 4 months' earnings were impacted by extremely colder than normal weather through the first 4 months of the year, like it was over 7% colder than normal, and sales were up about 7% as well. And this earnings projection for the year also assumes the implementation then of our Big Stone AQCS environmental tracker that's requested to be effective July 1st as well. We included that in our projections. And including the colder winter and taking into account the rider, we're going to be at our established return. Also part of the settlement, any earnings in excess of our 10.75% in 2014 would be shared 50-50 then with the customers. The natural gas pipeline that serves the turbine would be a part of the North Dakota gas rate base, and the gas segment would charge then the Heskett 3 a reservation fee for use of the pipeline to be recovered through the fuel and purchase power adjustment, rate 58. Any additional revenues received for natural gas services to third parties from the pipeline or for reliability and support of Montana-Dakota's gas distribution system would be then a credit then to this fee.
you mentioned that as part of the settlement agreement that the company agreed to a refund of to customers in the event that its return on equity exceeded 10.75%. Would that be regardless of whether the company later chose to file or refile the rate adjustment for ESCID 3?
That's correct. It would be in effect for 2014.
And does the settlement agreement also address the manner in which the rate adjustment would be recovered for ESCID 3?
It does, and what's proposed in the settlement agreement is that the recovery would be on a fixed charge basis and allocated on demand. And the support of that is that the unit is in service to meet peak load capacity purposes.
Is that how the company originally proposed to cover the rate adjustment under the generation rider for ESCID 3?
Originally, it was requested to recover it under KWH.
Can you briefly explain the difference in philosophies, if there is, in terms of whether this is a charge that would be recovered as on a customer basis versus a KWH basis?
Well, I guess the company, you know, supports the settlement in that on a fixed charge basis allocated on demand. Again, it's for peak load capacity, and everyone shares in that peak load capacity. And it would be, in terms of cost, that on average use per annual consumption, it would be about the same under both scenarios, fixed charge or on a KWH.
For an average use customer.
For an average use customer, right. The company also looked at that as well. And Ms. Aberle can further explain, you know, all the details if you want to get into that.
You mentioned capacity. Is the purpose of ESCID 3 primarily to provide capacity?
Correct.
You mentioned the fact that the company was withdrawing at this time its request for a rate adjustment for the ESCID 3 recovery. Can you explain how the company would go about determining whether it needed to refile that rate adjustment and what it would do in support of such a refiling?
What we plan to do and what we normally do is that as we go through the year, we'd update our projections for actuals. And, you know, by the time the unit is in place after August, we would know probably what type of summer we're having. And at that point, if it's a cool summer and our new projections would show that the earnings would be inadequate to support a return, we would then file to place then that rider into effect. And, you know, the settlement calls for, you know, roughly 30 days or to react quickly, if you will, to put that rider into effect. And, you know, as we go through the summer, we also be in contact then, you know, with advocacy staff and sharing, you know, the results for the year.
And is it the position of the company that the settlement agreement is in the best interest of customers?
Yes.
So all the questions I have for Mr. Singer, we'd offer them for cross-examination.
Okay. Mr. Norrell?
Thank you, Your Honor. Advocacy staff has no questions for this witness.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Yeah, I have a few, but you knew that. The turnaround time, if and when you file for recovery under the rider, the turnaround time is short, and that's why there's some provisions in the settlement, I'm assuming.
Correct.
You can correct me if I'm wrong. Some provisions in there for how that such a filing would be treated, what staff would think of such a filing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And can you tell me, again, I know you just answered Dan's question, but I'd like a little more information on the difference between how you originally requested recovery, volumetric, the fixed recovery that you would file under in the future, and why you did one and now you're doing the other or proposing the other.
I mean, I think Ms. Aberle probably can explain, you know, all the details of that, but just from a conceptual basis, I know that it is a unit for capacity, and everyone shares in that capacity, so I think that supports then that fixed charge on recovery of ESCID 3. And we also looked then the impact to an average residential customer. And under both scenarios, it was right around that $2.50 per month. So based on that as well was another reason then to support a fixed fee.
But I'm curious why you didn't think about doing that originally on that basis.
Well, originally maybe traditionally rate recovery had been probably on a KWH, but, you know, we thought, okay, what is more appropriate as we worked with advocacy staff?
Okay. And is it your testimony that that $250 a month would kind of amount to the same charge for an average customer under either plan?
Correct.
Either process? Okay. And what are you using for average again? Average usage for a customer?
You know, I think it's probably in that 800 range or something. Ms. Aberle can verify that.
That's all I have at this time. Thanks.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Singer. you said a couple times that everybody shares in the capacity needs or requirements. Do they share equally? That's what it seems that you're suggesting with the flat charge, per, you know, customer charge.
You know, depending probably when the peak time of the day is and whether they're at home, whether they're still at work. I mean, not everybody shares equally, certainly, but I think if you're looking at a global, you know, customer base, you know, it is for capacity purposes on the warmest or coldest day of the year, depending upon when you need that peak, that it's there.
Okay. And is that typically how customer or how capacity resources are viewed as a customer type charge?
Well, we do allocate, you know, our capacity charges on a demand factor, you know, in terms of actual capacity charges. So from that perspective, but again,
okay, so
it varies.
Explain
by
that to me a little bit. I think I'm one step behind on keeping up with
some
of the
Aberle
terms.
I think Ms. can best explain, okay, you know, the details of the cost allocation between classes and
okay, and on the
both a demand perspective and then from a KWH perspective.
Okay. Is it? You're just here to talk about the settlement, correct?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask you some questions that may not just be related to the settlement, and if you want to defer them to somebody else, you can. The whole issue of the rider and creating a generation rider. If we take away the addition of generation resources as a driver for rate cases, what do you have left that drives a rate case? Isn't that the biggest driver of rate case? I mean you adding new generation resources?
That's certainly the investment side, and certainly your largest investments are your generation resources. You still have operating costs and distribution investments and some transmission investments as well that would be part of it. I guess we see this as, you know, outside of a general rate case, it's specific to a big asset, and you can debate the merits of that asset and, you know, put a rider into effect until such time we would file another general rate case, then you'd roll it into general rates.
But if you have a generation rider, I'm trying to understand what would drive you to have a rate case. Do you have a transmission rider?
Currently we have a transmission rider that we're covering costs from MISO through, correct.
And you have the rider to recover the new
environmental rider.
Yep, the environmental rider.
So what you have left would be what other investments you make across the company in putting distribution lines in, mm-hmm, as such, as well as your day-to-day operating costs would be part of general rate case filings.
And so I'm looking at the company's ROE, which is at 10.75%, and I'm wondering if you guys are trying to avoid going through a rate case so you can maintain that ROE. Because it's a pretty nice, you know, it's a pretty healthy ROE, certainly higher than what we recently granted.
Certainly that's not the reason that we chose a rider. We just felt that this was an individual investment that had been approved ADP-wise, so that takes less risk out of it, if you will. The purpose of that particular, you know, was already vetted.
You know. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. Would you be the witness to ask about the frequency of Heskett being used, or would that be Mr.
Welty?
Okay. Okay, I think that's all my questions for now. Thank you.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Garrett, for your testimony. I just had a Just two quick questions, and kind of a follow-up to what Commissioner Fedorchak was driving at. I think I read the initial filings, and I guess I understood where the company wanted to go. And then we've got the settlement agreement in front of us now. But why do you even need a settlement agreement? Why don't you just keep doing business the way you're doing it right now? And you're really not getting anything out of this settlement agreement that you couldn't do on your own. I'm trying to see why you don't just withdraw this whole thing and just keep doing your business and come back in a regular rate case.
I mean, I think we felt important to put this rider in place and have the ability for that rider. When we initially filed, you know, in February for this rider, at that point, we didn't even have 1 month into the year. So we needed it, and from our earnings perspective, we needed to file and put this rider into effect. It's just that after four months of extremely colder weather has driven our return.
How do you decide then, if you say you needed the rider, that means you need more revenue?
Correct.
Why wouldn't you just put a rate case in then? If you need more revenue, that's the purpose of rate cases.
We could have filed for a rate case, but again,
but what made you tip to a rider instead of a traditional rate case?
Again, the AD, you know, we did have an ADPM this year.
You
I think
it's
just less complicated by having a single issue in front of you. It'd be less complicated for this particular project or unit.
Fair enough. And then the last question I had, Garrett, was, I can't remember, when we did the siting of the gas line, were you involved in those hearings?
I believe I attended part of the hearing for that.
But wasn't it supposed to start out as a 6-inch gas line and then it increased to 10-inch gas line?
Right.
And we had some discussion in that hearing about this potential, about why wouldn't we, you know, we purposely, I think a 6-inch is what was needed. And then you built it 10 inches to accommodate future growth and other things. And so I think that's a good idea. But tell me again how this will conceptually, the gas side will own the whole pipeline?
Correct. And then on a monthly basis, there will be a calculation of a fee that the gas segment or business will charge then Heskett 3.
Okay, so if you have other people that want those gas services, then you'll enter into contracts with them?
Correct.
And how long will those contracts be?
It could be annual. I mean, I guess it would be between the company and the customer. They could vary. But if we ever needed the use of that pipeline, there would be a clause in there stating that, you know, that.
Okay, that was the point I was getting to, is it'd be a shame if at some point MDU needed this gas and you couldn't. So is that something, where is that clause written at?
And Mr. Welch probably can address.
Okay.
You know, it'll be spelled out in future contracts.
All right, thank you.
Commissioner Christman?
My questions have been answered. Thank you.
Okay. Any follow-up, Mr. Koontz?
No further questions.
Mr. Norell?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
Yeah, a couple. Is it safe to say investors love riders?
Certainly, if you take risk off the table. It also, you know, you're probably going out for financing. Creditors and rating analysts, they will look at each jurisdiction, what you have in place, what type of regulatory approaches you have, and when they price out, you know, they'll give you a rating, and certainly all those things are favorable in terms of financing and as such.
But you've accomplished that same thing with the ADP, have you not? With just the ADP, without the rider, you still accomplish that reduction in risk and the things you're
somewhat
talking about.
Reduction risk, but there's still the recovery of that as well. So that's another component or piece of it that would certainly be highlighted and make the recovery more certain.
So the risk that you're going to, whenever you want money to pay for that plant, actual customer money, the risk that remains is whether you're asking for the right amount and how to recover it. Now, by putting that provision in for how to recover it, the rider plus which charge it's going to go in, you've pretty much reduced everything except for the question of, is the number correct? Is that safe?
Right, and the cost. You still have the cost of the project as well.
That you would have to prove at
yes.
whatever time, if challenged.
Yes.
Okay. You keep referring to this, the charge as, or the cost as capacity, but as Jerry just said to me, why do they call it demand? I mean, capacity and demand are the same thing, correct?
They are.
And it's called demand because of Commissioner Fedorchak's question,
yep.
because it varies with demand.
Right.
correct?
Correct.
So does it not result, if you use that charge to recover this, does it not result in subsidization, one customer subsidizing another, and possibly unreasonably?
But I think you could make that argument maybe for a lot of different types of assets, right? I mean, what is the use of that? How do you, for a residential customer?
Is that a yes?
If it's specifically for demand, you know, everybody shares in that common asset, right? I mean, if everybody turned on, every appliance and all the lights in their house, every electric component at one time, and granted, not everybody does that, and turns up their central cooling systems all at one time.
So the customer with the light bulb in the shed out back is subsidizing the person that's going home and turning on the dishwasher, the garbage disposal, the air conditioning, ironing, the TV, and the computer. We won't even talk businesses. I mean, I know I'm overgeneralizing, but is that a correct overgeneralization?
It's probably an overgeneralization. Yeah.
Okay. So the question that the commission has to ask is that subsidy that's probably going to result if you took enough looked at enough scenarios in enough detail, is it unreasonable?
Right. And based on looking at what the fee would be under a KWH component and the annual fee or monthly fee of that as compared to the demand, they were both about the same for an average customer, and hence that's why we felt comfortable by then, as part of the settlement, using the demand for recovering this basis.
Okay, and forgive me for not finding this myself if it's in there, but do you have that same kind of comparison for other customers?
I think we can, if you probably direct that question to Ms. Aberle, she probably can answer that.
Do you know what the commission precedent is on this issue?
I do not.
And do you agree that, as you mentioned a couple questions ago, every charge might result in some subsidy, but that is the purpose of trying to do a really good, careful job in cost allocation, is it not?
It is, but I guess it comes down to reasonableness as well. You know, we looked at that, and that was really for our consideration, that was one of the driving factors.
Okay, that's all I have. Thanks.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Mr. Singer, are there any benefits to customers for riders?
I think as part of they can maybe understand specifically that if they're paying for new generation, I think that is a benefit that, you know, we put this plant on for capacity and it's dedicated, you know, in this rider. And it's a fixed fee. They understand monthly what they will pay for that specific unit. And it tracks the recovery of that unit.
And tell me what the benefits for you are. Why does the company prefer the rider again?
Again, I think it takes it out of a long, drawn-out general rate case.
So it's speed?
The unit goes online in July, and so we're, had requests to recover start in August, so we try to line up recovery starting mm-hmm. when the customer has a benefit, and one way to achieve that is then through a rider.
Okay. If approved, would this generation rider be available for you to use for any future generation resources?
That's what we're thinking.
Okay. Then if the company you'd have full recovery regardless of which way you get it versus the customer charge versus KW charge. So why did you go with the customer charge?
Well, I think that was just part of the settlement process, and that's.
Did you want that? Was that something the company advocated for, or was that something that the staff?
I think I'll let Mr. maybe Diller in his testimony explain maybe how that approach came forward, but it was at the end of the day we both agreed to it.
But you wanted it.
And initially, when we filed, it was on a KWH basis.
Okay.
But again, after we analyzed both what it for a residential customer, what that monthly fee would be under both scenarios, it was just about the same. So.
Yeah, but again, that's average.
That's average.
I mean,
correct.
you're taking out the highs and lows in an average. So if it's a demand charge, and how I understand demand charges, you pay more if you demand more, right? So you're basically flattening that, though, with this recovery mechanism. Okay. All right, well, I'll listen to what the staff has in terms of reasons for wanting that. I think that's all my questions.
Commissioner Kolk? Yeah. Commissioner Christman?
No.
Okay. Mr. Kuntz, anything else?
Yes, I do have a few questions. I want to follow up in response to some of the questions Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco asked you. Mr. Singer, and if you prefer to refer these questions to Ms. Averly, that's fine. Would you agree with me that in the course of rate design and cost allocations for electric, there's generally three major components: energy,
correct,
demand, and customer costs? Would you agree with that?
Correct.
And you try to take each cost element and put them into one or another of those combination or some combination of those components. Would you
correct.
Agree with that? And for industrial and commercial customers, you actually have rates that follow that design, where you have a demand charge, correct?
You have all three components.
You have all three components. You've got an energy charge based on KWH. You've got a demand charge based upon demand measurements. And then you've got a customer component that's charged on a month per customer basis. Would
correct.
You agree with that?
I do.
On the residential customers, do you have that particular rate design where you actually measure or have a demand component to residential customer bills?
You have an energy charge and a customer charge.
You don't have a demand component like you do for industrial or commercial.
I guess I would let Ms. Averly confirm that, but that's correct.
And then there was a question about whether the customer who's got a light bulb in the shed burning might be subsidizing the residential customer whose dishwasher is running. You remember that question?
Yes.
With respect to the demand component, is the answer to that question of who's subsidizing the other with respect to demand dependent upon when that light bulb is being used
correct.
Versus when that dishwasher is being used?
That's correct, because it would all contribute towards a peak, if you will.
So if the dishwasher is running at 8 o'clock at night and the light bulb is running at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 10 o'clock in the morning, which one is contributing to demand?
They're both probably out of the demand period. I mean, it would, if you had the light bulb on at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, then that would certainly be contributing to more to the peak than if you the dishwasher.
Then the dishwasher would
correct.
Be. So in that case, actually, the dishwasher might be subsidizing the light bulb.
It's all depending upon time of when they would have the need or use to run the appliances or put the lights on. Correct.
That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Norrell?
No questions, thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I only have one more question. Thanks, Dan. my dishwasher, of course, is so efficient that it doesn't subsidize anybody. If the method of collection in the future, which as we sit here and talk may be a really premature thing to even be deciding in this case, but if it were to not be decided in accordance with the settlement, is that a deal breaker for the company?
Not a deal breaker.
Okay. That's all. Thanks.
Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Nothing.
Commissioner Kolk? Commissioner Crispin? Mr. Kuntz, anything else?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Singer. You can step down. You can call your next witness, Mr. Kuntz.
Call Alan Welty.
Mr. Welty, I'm required to advise you that the penalty for perjury in North Dakota is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $5,000, maximum of 5 years imprisonment, or both. Being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Go ahead, Mr. Kuntz.
Would you please state your name and business address?
My name is Alan Welty. My business address is 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck.
And you're employed by Montana Dakota Utilities?
Yes.
And what's your position with Montana?
My position is Director of Generation.
And did you cause to be prepared pre-filed testimony in support of the company's original application in this case?
Yes, I did.
I show you what's been marked as Exhibit Number 2. Can you identify that?
Yes.
And what is that?
This is my pre-filed testimony in this matter.
And that was prepared by you or under your direction?
Yes.
And considering there's been a lapse of time since this was pre-filed, but the information that was provided in here at the time was correct?
Yes.
We would offer Exhibit MDU 2.
Any objection, Mr. Norell?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, thank you.
Okay, MDU Exhibit 2 is admitted.
And Mr. Welty, would be a fair summary of your pre-filed testimony. Just talked about the status of the Heskett 3 project. Is that correct?
That is correct.
We would tender Mr. Welty for cross-examination.
Mr. Norell?
Your Honor, advocacy staff would waive cross at this point.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
We don't have any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Sure. Mr. Welty, can you... I read in the testimony that someplace that this was resource was only going to be running just a small percentage of the time. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that is?
Sure. This resource is a peaking generating resource. Typically, on an average, even across the nation, you would expect to see these running in the less than 5% capacity factor. And it's yet to be determined, but our modeling would indicate that it would likely operate 5% or less of the time, at least initially.
And did I see 1% someplace? That it was going to be running less than 1%?
Yeah, there in the documents you had before you, in one place our operating model suggested it might be closer to 5%, and our more recent models say about 1%. However, knowing where it's situated and its ability to participate in reliability in this region, we feel it will be more than 1% in actuality.
Okay. This project has come in under budget, correct?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit? And here's a chance to brag.
Sure. This is a really great project. The project is coming in under budget. In my testimony, I said about, I believe it's about 11%, but that's primarily due to a number of reasons. First of all, the equipment contracts came in at or under budget. The schedule, we were able to compress the schedule to some degree. That affected the amount of AFUDC that would be calculated against the project. Those are the primary
Is a big part of it, too, the spinning off of the line, the gas line? Is that part of the lower cost or not? Where that cost was taken out of the project?
When we look at the total project cost, the combustion turbine and an interconnection costs are somewhat below budget. The gas pipe itself is somewhat a little bit above budget, so or our estimate.
Am I misunderstanding that the cost of the pipe is now not going to be included in this project, though? The cost of the pipeline is... Did I misunderstand that?
As far as my definition of the project, because it's under my responsibility, I'm still considering it all part of the project. However, as the previous witness testified, we're in the process of changing the ownership of the pipe from the electric side to the gas side of the business. So with that, there'll be an agreement. Is under draft that will provide the basis for doing that handoff, including those costs.
Okay. And so the customers won't be charged those costs under the rider, whatever mechanism is created to recover these costs. They'll be charged maybe the gas or whatever.
Yeah, that's my understanding, and Ms. Aberle can get into those details a little more.
Okay. And then this isn't completely specific to this project, but just help me understand a little bit, since you're the technical guy, how this the Heskett facility is positioned longer term. You've got gas now and coal. Is there a potential for a combined cycle unit at that location in the future?
Yes, even with the design of the Heskett 3 project, including the pipeline, we made sure that we would have the capacity and to put additional generation in that area. And as well as the Heskett 3 site, we laid that out so that we would have the ability to add additional combustion turbine and convert it to a combined cycle. In addition to that, the company continues to look at those options as well as a larger combined cycle combustion turbine in the Mandan region.
How large of a facility could that be, like in terms of megawatts, if you were to add on? How much capacity do you have there for additional growth megawatts?
For instance, if we were to put in a larger class machine that would be efficiently placed in combined cycle, say a GE7FA, we depending on how much duct firing that would be included, we could get almost another 400 megawatts, locate almost a whole 400 megawatts in that region. And we would have the gas capacity to do that with additional compression and using that pipe.
And would that be in addition to how much is already there? So what would the total be then?
The total under that circumstance would be, say, 488 megawatts or a little less. Not including the existing Heskett station, which is another 100.
100, yeah. So almost 600. Okay. I think that's all my questions. Thank you.
Great. Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Alan, for your testimony. Just a couple quick ones. To extend what Commissioner Fedorchuk just asked you, that was a question I had in the gas flow. So you're telling me roughly that if you had constant flow going through your 10-inch line, you could have combined cycle for 400 megawatts and the addition and the current 88 megawatts?
Yes, that's correct. However, not as the pipeline's configured presently. Sure. We'd have to add compression. And
then the way it is now with a simple cycle, 5% of the time, let's say you're going to use that gas. So how much do you, and this may be a question for Tammy, but how much do you anticipate then making available for others to use? There's 95% that you're never going to use, sometimes 100%. How much do you think you'd want to be able to sell off?
In order for us to count that unit as a resource in our resource adequacy, we would have to reserve the capacity to run it at any time at that capacity.
But do you just have to reserve 5%?
No, we would have to reserve the amount of capacity to...
So do you know what percentage of that 10-inch line it uses when it's running? These are more curiosity.
Yeah, that would be difficult to...
But you have to figure that out if you're going to sell it off.
Sure, yeah. We would reserve the daily maximum capacity on the pipeline to support Heskett 3 as well as some additional generation. Okay. So right now, for instance, the maximum daily usage for Heskett 3, if you ran it 24 hours, would be about 29,000 decatherms. A 7FA, as I mentioned, in combined cycle mode with duct firing could go up as much as be about, say, 60,000 or a little more decatherms per day.
Okay. No, that's good.
Thank you.
Tammy, that's coming your way, all right? Thanks, Alan.
Commissioner Chrisman?
Thanks, Your Honor. How would you draw the line between, say, a really efficient and heavily utilized peaking plant compared to a pretty inefficient and maybe not very necessary baseload plant? Is there a line where under so much percent of the time it's considered peaking and... How do you figure that?
Certainly, as we do our resource modeling, we include all of our existing resources. For instance, we have several older coal-fired plants in that mix. And as we do our resource modeling, we would tend to see, we would offer those into the model as well as new resources. And as the pricing would change so that the model would start choosing a new resource or a market purchase, and we would start seeing the capacity factors drop off in the modeling results on one of our other units, that would be a clue for us to say, okay, does it make sense to start having a plan to replace that unit in the future.
But if you're short a generation, and you talked about, you know, this may be running 5% of the time, but what if you found that you're needing it, and you're running it 10 or 15% of the time? Is it still a peaking plant then? Or 25% or, you know?
Oh, where's the line where that would occur?
That you would say, I guess it's really not a peaking plant, it's a baseload plant now.
Right. I would hesitate to say what a percentage would be, but I would say that if you would start operating the plant over, say, 10-15%, that's operating the resource in a manner that probably different than the initial design.
And so,
not that it couldn't do that, it's just...
Does having this peaking plant or a number of other peaking plants, does that lessen the chance or get calculated into the reason, into the justification for new baseload power?
To the extent that when we look at future resources and how to cover our demand and so forth, we would look at how we're going to supply our capacity requirements and energy, and as it would compare to other resources and it's against its energy price, that would determine its relationship to a future baseload plant. So I'm not sure if that answers your question.
It does, and thanks for accommodating. I know it's a little off topic, but while we have the expert here, I wanted to know these things, so thank you. Nothing else.
Mr. Kuntz, anything further? Mr. Norrell?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Do you have any information or knowledge about what tariff the excess gas, I hate to use the word excess, but you know what I mean, gas sales are going to be made under? If it's a tariff or if it's going to be a contract or?
I think that's a Tammy question.
It's a Tammy. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I would defer that to Tammy. It's my understanding we would file an agreement.
Okay, thanks.
Commissioner Fedorchak, anything further? Commissioner Kolk?
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Chrisman? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Welty. You can step down. You can call your next witness.
Call Tammy Averly.
Ms. Averly, I would advise you that the penalty for perjury in North Dakota is a Class C felony punishable by a maximum fine of $5,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay.
Would you please state your name and business address, Ms. Averly?
My name is Tammy A. Averly. My business address is 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck, North Dakota, 58501.
And you're employed by Montana Dakota Utilities?
Yes, I am.
And what's your position?
Director of Regulatory Affairs.
Ms. Averly, in front of you is the exhibit book. I want to go through the exhibits and have you identify the ones that haven't been offered yet. Would you take a look at what's been marked as MDU Exhibit Number 1 and identify that for us, please?
MDU Exhibit Number 1 is our initial application submitted in this docket.
And was that application prepared under your direction?
Yes, it was.
And then would you turn to Exhibit Number 3 and tell us what Exhibit Number 3 is?
MDU Exhibit 3 is my pre-filed direct testimony in support of the application originally filed in this case.
And that was the information contained in there was prepared by you or under your direction?
Yes, it was.
And was true and correct at the time it was prepared?
Yes.
And then finally, if you would turn to Exhibit Number 4, MDU Exhibit Number 4, could you describe what that is?
MDU Exhibit Number 4 is an amended application, and my direct testimony supporting that amended application, wherein Montana Dakota removed the cost of the gas pipeline from the generation tracker.
We would offer MDU Exhibits Number 1, 3, and 4.
Mr. Norrell, any objection to any of the exhibits?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No.
Okay. MDU Exhibits Number 1, 3, and 4 are admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Abele, there were a number of questions that were kind of referred to you during the course of the prior examination, but first of all, could you explain how the difference between how the company is proposing to recover a rate adjustment tracker for HESCOT 3 if and when it files for such an adjustment versus what the company originally proposed, and what would be the rate-making philosophies that would support either one of those two alternatives?
Yes, Montana Dakota originally submitted its application and was applying the total cost of the generation tracker on a per kilowatt hour or an energy basis to all customer classes. Really, I think even as noted in the testimony, was it was consistent with how we had applied other trackers. Through discussions with staff and through the data request response process, and then as that developed into the settlement agreement, in looking at that cost recovery closer as a capacity resource or as a demand related resource, we would, in a rate case proceeding, we would allocate those costs based on demand. And typically, a residential class in total has it's a pretty consistent demand throughout the residential class. There certainly will be the outliers, but based on load studies, a residential class is going to have a pretty similar load factor, which would say if you allocated that cost on a demand basis, it would go to that residential class in that manner and would be could be recovered on a demand basis. The other, has also been discussed, the general service classes, we do have the metering available to price our services based on customer demand and energy. On the residential side, while the costs are coming down, it's still really not cost effective to put a demand meter on each and every residential customer. And that's also supported by load studies that we prepare that says, for the most part, that residential class has a pretty similar demand factor. And so it really wouldn't be cost effective to go through the cost of that metering, which would allow us to charge each and every customer based exactly on their demand. So I step back a little bit in a rate case process. As we said, we allocate those costs between customer demand and energy. And because once we've allocated those costs, you look at the residential class, we would advocate that some of those demand-related costs should be recovered through the what's called the customer component. We refer to it on our tariff as a basic service charge because it truly isn't always just customer-related costs. Customer-related costs are typically your service line, your facilities that are dedicated to that customer. However, in the rate design process, we would advocate that the demand costs, at least a portion of them, be recovered through that fixed cost basis, and just as we do on the general service schedules. It really does support and it rewards your higher load factor customers. To the extent you have a fixed cost or a capacity-related cost charged out and billed on the basis of how it of what it's comprised of, it will more efficiently price that service. So if you have a customer that more efficiently uses service, they may have a high demand, but their energy is also going to be much higher. So if we were to charge all of this on an energy basis, that higher load factor customer will be subsidizing the more inefficient user on the system.
So to break this down, first of all, between customer classes, this unit will be broken out between classes based upon demand. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And within the commercial and industrial customers, that charge or cost will be recovered on a demand basis on the customer's bill. That's correct?
That is correct.
So from that standpoint, there's really no difference between the settlement proposal and the company's original application when it comes to recovery from the commercial industrial customer. Is that right?
We had, in our original, we did have everything on a kilo, on an energy. So
now we're moving that over to a demand side for those
are.
Customers as well.
Yes.
And if we're in a general rate case, you would allocate your generation resources on demand depending upon whether they were base load, as Commissioner Chrisman referred to, versus peaking, to determine whether they were more demand-related versus energy-related resources. Is that right?
We will look at the type of generation. For the most part, we consider generation base load or peakers to be demand or capacity-related.
Okay, so those peaking units in a general rate case then on the commercial industrial side, as those roll through the rate design piece of it, would those costs tend to get allocated then to the demand charges for those customers?
Yes, they would.
And on the residential customer, as I understand your testimony correctly, it would be the company's position that some or all of those demand charges should be recovered through a fixed-type charge as opposed to a baseload unit, which would be recovered on an energy basis. Is that right?
We would advocate that capacity-related costs, yes, should be recovered on a fixed basis.
But being fair here, historically, most of those generation resources have been recovered primarily through the KWH energy charges, even for residential customers?
Yes, that is true. I think in the last couple of rate cases, and as we've discussed in the gas utility, we have not, and for the most part, the rate designs have probably been on an equal percentage increase basis, and again, moving toward that cost recovery that we believe is supported by the class study, but not always getting to that.
So the settlement would be more in accord with what the company would advocate as a better cost recovery mechanism, a more cost reflective in the customer's rates. Is that
correct?
You also heard testimonies that were directed, or questions were directed to Mr. Singer on regarding the question of general rate case versus riders. You recall that line of questioning?
Yes.
If the company had decided, or as I understood Mr. Singer's testimony back in February, it appeared that it was going to need a rate case for the as a result of the HESCA 3 generation unit. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And how would that determination have been made? If you were to file a rate case, what would you have used for a test year in that scenario?
We would have looked at a projected 2014-2015 test period. And, in fact, we looked at that. And the main driver of a rate case was the Heskett 3 turbine. And provided then looking at a generation tracker, providing that opportunity to as we even look forward, smaller increments of generation potentially till we get to the big unit that we've been talking about may provide some opportunity to, with all of the support and all the review necessary, to not, you know, load all of that on the customers at the same time. So it allows us to get that into rates more on a piecemeal basis, if you will.
So are you saying that when you looked at this back in February, the determination was you would not need a general rate case but for the Heskett, all other things being equal? Is that correct?
That is correct.
And if you'd have proceeded with the general rate case on the idea that Heskett 3 was going to be coming online, that would have been based upon projected revenues, average revenues, average weather, that sort of thing?
That is correct. We looked at normalized weather.
So based upon the application, if you decided to proceed with a general rate case, would we still be looking at a general rate increase despite the fact that the company had good earnings the first 3 months, as Mr. Singer referenced?
Yes, we would.
So and to that extent, has the rider benefited customers, or the use of the rider for the recovery of that in the manner proposed under the settlement been a benefit to customers?
Yes, I see it as a benefit. It's much more cost-effective. It's much cheaper in terms of getting to the same place, if you will, than a full-blown rate case. And it also, again, provides them the opportunity, these units are, as generation resources are coming online, to recognize that cost.
And so in those situations where usage is above what would have been projected in a general rate case, it softens the effect of the rider, which wouldn't be the case in a general rate case. Is that right?
Correct.
And then there were some questions, you recall, regarding treatment of the pipeline costs. You recall those questions?
Yes, I do.
Can you explain how the company proposes to handle the pipeline cost recovery both from the electric side and from third-party customers?
Upon approval of the settlement agreement, wherein the pipeline costs would be removed from the electric utility, moved over to the gas utility, and we would recover those costs associated with serving the turbine through the company's fuel cost adjustment, we will submit a contract for service between the gas utility and the electric utility. The intent is that the pipeline was built to serve that station and will continue to do so. However, in the event that there is a customer that requests service or there is a period of time where potentially the gas utility could serve that to provide a reliability service or reliability addition to our own distribution system, there would be a credit that would move toward to the electric system. So in effect, my understanding, the pipeline today without additional, just as it is today without additional compression, we would set a MDDQ or a maximum daily delivery quantity at 90,000. So 90,000 decatherms. The electric utility will pay for that 90,000. To the extent, and again, we enter into an agreement with a customer, we would first and foremost make that an interruptible service agreement so that we can always call on that gas customer to interrupt their service. They know that up front. It's a standard tariff that we offer, and many of our customers utilize that service today. So we would first ensure that we can call on that at any time. But in the interim, until we do get a second turbine there or potentially the larger unit, we do know that there will be incremental capacity available. And so to the extent we can provide a benefit to the electric customers and serving gas customers, as was noted, it really seemed to be a win-win for both sides.
And that's all the questions I have for Ms. Haberle.
Mr. Norrell?
Thank you, Your Honor. No questions at this time.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Couple, thanks. We talked a little bit just now with Mr. Kuntz about commission precedent for rate design, and you did explain what I understood to be your understanding of commission precedent and the company's objectives. Would you specifically, are you aware of the specific commission precedent for rate design for riders? Other companies that have generation riders, and if you do know what that commission precedent is, if there's any differences between that and the settlement.
I do not know of a similar rider for peaking capacity.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchuk?
So you and Mr. Kuntz were talking about the benefits of a rider for customers, and at the end he summarized it. And I'd like you to do that again, if you wouldn't mind, about how a rider allows, there's more flexibility in a rider in terms of costs going up and down that benefit a customer more than a general rate case would.
Yes, I think an example that we visited about in terms of why we wanted to move forward with a rider, another example would be bonus tax depreciation that has, there is some discussion that that may potentially be extended into 2014. While we were able to realize a nice benefit to customers for the amount of investment made in 13, if that were to come to be, we would be able to quickly recognize that and reflect that in this rider rate and reduce the cost to customers. In a rate case, that gets, you know, it's part of a much bigger package, and there is probably some other cost offsetting that decrease that wouldn't say you'd come in and reduce your overall rate. So I think, as was mentioned, as just us not implementing the rider at this time based on the results from this past winter, it provides that flexibility as we move forward and until we get to the general rate case, which there are a number of other investments that are being made distribution-wide, even generation for the generation side that would not fall through this, would not fall into this generation rider by definition, that would eventually cause us to need to look at all of all of the costs in an entire rate case.
Mm-hmm. So in simple terms, the rider is more reflective of actual costs and is adjusted on an annual basis versus a rate case sets the rates and that's where they are until the next rate
case. It provides the opportunity for that adjustment, yes.
Yeah. Okay, I think the rest of my questions on rate design have been covered. Thanks.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Tammy. The reading through your testimony, tell me again what percentage of this project is going to be for North Dakota ratepayers.
Approximately 72% of this project is assigned to North Dakota customers based on North Dakota's demand.
Okay, so the other, what did you just say, 72? So the other 28, I guess, percent, where does that go, South Dakota or Minnesota, Wyoming or Montana?
Montana and South Dakota are part of our integrated system, so we will be looking to recover those costs in those two states.
That was my next question. Have you filed this similar thing in those states?
We have not at this time. In South Dakota, we have not. South Dakota represents about 6% of our business. We have not actually filed a rate case there since the late 1980s, and so we have not been able to avail ourselves of any tracking adjustments until we reset all of those rates. And in Montana, Montana is a historic test period, historic meaning where we can only go so far forward in our adjustments. Quite as forward-looking as North Dakota is in that regard. And so we're trying to manage when we would file for that, but we certainly will request recovery. It may be initially through a rate case, and then our goal would be to establish these trackers as much as we have here, similar to what we have in North Dakota for transmission and generation on a go-forward basis.
I'm sure you followed the rate cases we've had with Xcel Energy and the challenges between different states and who's paying what at what time. I guess that's the concern I would have, is that so if 28% of this cost is not going to be picked up, who covers that? The company just covers that until you go back and get it sorted out in South Dakota and Montana?
The company, depending upon where sales are in those two states, where other costs lie in those
two. Isn't that the only choice? The company's got to front those costs.
We run or reduce costs, reduce O&M, or increase revenues.
Okay. So, well, it just gets back to North Dakota is going to be asked for an increase because the company can't cover the 72% that you're asking us to increase the rates on eventually, which
yes.
We have an ADP for as well. But how do you determine... We've had a lot of discussion with Xcel that when you file a rate case in North Dakota, you better be filing one in Minnesota because we don't want to be getting back and ahead of things, make sure everybody's paying their fair share. How do you assess that in different states?
Well,
if you said you haven't been in South Dakota for a long time, it's more than just these costs that are out there that you may be having more costs than are truly being paid by other state ratepayers.
We look at the returns provided by each of those states, and North Dakota's demand factor is increasing. So by that, I mean North Dakota is causing more costs.
Sure.
On the integrated basis than South Dakota. That by and far is the largest reason why we haven't needed to go in to change rates because their costs are decreasing as North Dakota's increase. For those assets, those integrated system assets that are allocated based on demand of that state. And in Montana, we're working toward a rate case in Montana. Again, we have to manage that with the various laws in place. And Montana has a very strict known and measurable law. So they're almost looking back in time when when setting rates. So to avoid pancaking a rate case with customers, we try to manage it that way.
Fair enough. Is MDU starting to, let me rephrase that question. I think MDU is starting to view peakers the same way as renewables, why you want to put everything in the same tariff. How would your response to that question be?
I believe, I don't agree with that.
But you're trying to use the same purchase power adjustment rate 58, which is a renewable one, which is what we use for our wind farms.
No, this would be a separate mechanism. It may have chosen, we just look at what rate numbers we're using in order to have a rate schedule assigned to it. But it's its own rider. The investments we've made in renewable generation resources, generation assets, are part of our retail base rates. So
I thought I read somewhere in your testimony that you were going to ask for a change in the company's fuel and purchase power adjustment rate 58.
And the reason for that change, I apologize, I missed your question there. The reason for that change is to recover those pipeline-related costs that we referred to. So there's reservation charges associated with getting the gas to the Heskett Station and the pipeline itself. Those are the costs that we would consider.
You're talking the pipeline costs, not the. So there'd be a new tariff set up for this completely?
Yes, this would be a separate tariff.
Okay, I understand. Yes. Tell me again now. Explain. Okay, so on your page 4 of your testimony, you're talking about just in general the cost of purchase power agreements for both capacity, both current and the future, would be recovered through. You talk about 58. That's talking about wind farms, isn't it?
No, it is not. It would be if we were to enter into a capacity agreement, or if we were that we would, and that is present today. We recover the cost of demand through the fuel and purchase power adjustment.
But when you talk about it, if you guys go out and buy a wind farm purchase power agreement, isn't that exactly what you're talking about on that page?
If we purchase energy from a wind farm, yes, that would roll through our fuel and purchase power because it would be similar to MISO energy. Energy we purchase on the MISO market. There's no change that we're proposing here today that would be required to roll or to run that renewable generation, the wind generation energy, through the fuel cost adjustment.
And correct me if I'm don't remember this correctly, but when you do go through and enter into purchase power agreement, it's not an automatic. You file with the commission, and we can choose to have a hearing on that or not, correct?
Yes, we would support that. Once we enter into the purchase power agreement, we've supported it through we have entered into a purchase power agreement that we have advise the commission of. It's included in our integrated resource plan. At this time, we do not intend to submit that agreement for approval per se. When that agreement is in place, it would be similar to purchasing energy from the MISO market, and would be certainly we would need to. You would always have the opportunity to be sure we are prudent through the review of the fuel and purchase power
agreement. Once again, referring to the Xcel discussion that's taken place, they entered into several purchase power agreements that got quite contested when they got into the rate case. So I would just caution the company as they enter into these things and just think it's going to be automatic to flow through. It might not always be the case. And maybe, that's not the point of today, I guess.
I think, yeah, and this one was supported in our integrated resource plan.
But I would say that the integrated resource plan never gets approved by the commission. It's filed. We don't ever act on it and say we approve it. So just the fact that you say it was submitted in your IRP doesn't mean that it's been blessed by the commission.
And that, understood.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. The last thing, Tammy, is do you need authorization to, quote, repurpose this pipeline from the commission? Can't you just do that on your own?
I believe we need, the authority we need is for the charge that we will the charge will be charging the electric utility. So
how could that authority be granted outside of this settlement agreement?
We could file for an agreement And that's really what I would envision, not a general purpose tariff, but an agreement. We have a few of those on file with the commission. So if we enter into something that's outside of our approved tariffs, we will enter that agreement as a contract.
Got it.
And I wouldn't read too much into my questions on this. I think this is a pretty novel idea, and I'm not really sure where I'm going to come down on it yet. But I do have, I would tell you, some just concerns about why we wouldn't just do this in a rate case. But if you're viewing peakers as things that they're going to come up, you can't really tell how much you're going to use them. You don't know what tax breaks may or not be there. It's very similar to a wind farm where you've got the production tax credits that they're kind of changing. You can depreciate those assets out pretty quick. There's a reason that I believe is appropriate for the wind farms to use tariffs or riders. So I think that's it. Thank you, Tammy.
Commissioner Chrisman?
No other questions.
Mr. Kuntz, anything else?
No.
Mr. Norrell?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
A couple prompted by the last discussion. I should remember this, but I don't. Do you have the ADP for the pipeline and the plant or just for the plant?
For both.
That's what I thought. So it might be a question for Mr. Kuntz, but there probably has to be a little bit of tweaking either in what you file, the agreement you file, just because you have to kind of answer the obligation everybody assumes you now have under that ADP for that line. Is that correct?
I've given this a lot of thought, but when you think about the fact that it's the same company that owns it, so title is not changing. What we're doing is basically moving it from the rate base of one arm of the company to the rate base of the other arm of the company, but then kind of reflecting that one is going to get charged for that with some credits back. You know, Ms. Aberle and I have had a lot of discussions about, you know, what's the appropriate way to accomplish this, and we've come to the conclusion that just, you know, you move the investment from one side of the books to the other, but then have this special agreement in place so that you properly reflect the charges back onto the electric side, which was originally approved for the ADP. So I think that's the proper way to do it, and I think, as Ms. Aberle indicated, the commission will have a chance to agree or disagree with that proposal when we make the filing of that special contract. But as you can see by the settlement agreement is reflecting that philosophically that's the right way to do it, is to move that investment to the gas side, charge the electric side, credit the electric side with any revenues. You know, at the end of the day, it looks the same to the electric customer, except for the fact that it's now getting credit to the extent that the gas sale side can use that pipe to make sales to third-party customers, or to the extent it's utilized to improve reliability on the gas system. So as we mentioned before, and it's probably a cliche, win-win, but the electric side still has the benefit of the pipeline, which the ADP was approved for, but now it's getting the credit for any additional sales utilization that we can make off of that pipeline without jeopardizing full access to that pipeline by the electric side. So we've had that discussion, and you know, ordinarily you think about, do we need a transfer request? But you're just transferring it to yourself, so that didn't really seem to fit. So this is what we came up with.
I just want to be sure that if approved and you end up filing this, you might have to go a little bit overboard in explaining it so that there is somebody looking at the docket 5 years from now understands what happened. My other question was, are there any waivers to the fuel adjustment rules necessary for the way you're going to use the costs and credits in the fuel adjustment? I have not looked at that. I don't know the answer to that question.
I do not believe so.
Okay. Thanks. That's all I have.
Commissioner Fedorchak, anything else?
No.
Commissioner Kalk?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Kuntz, anything further?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Aberle. You can step down.
That completes our presentation, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Norrell, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. I would call Mike Diller to the stand.
Your Honor, maybe just 5 minutes. Is that
sure.
All right?
I guess, yeah, it's the logical spot for a break. It's been about an hour and a half, so let's take a quick break.